With virtually limitless design options, Pella is like your personal barista for windows and doors. Customize your order by August 31st and you can bundle and save big at Pella Windows and Doors of Wisconsin. Get started today at PellaWI.com.
Live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's the Jeff Wagner Show. Come join the conversation on the Old National Bank talk and text line at 855-616-1620. Old National Bank. Get old. Now, here's WTMJ's Jeff Wagner.
Good afternoon, Wisconsin. Welcome to the show. So glad to have you with us. Let me name drop for a minute. Last night I was in an event. I might talk a little bit about that later on. But one of the people I ran into was Summerfest CEO Don Smiley. We had a drink together. And I bring that up because, first of all, a week from today is the first day of Summerfest. And we will be broadcasting live my program. Now, keep in mind, Summerfest this year is going to be Thursday, Friday, Saturday, three consecutive weekends, and we will be broadcasting live, I believe, every weekday of the three-week run of Summerfest. This is actually Don's last year as CEO, and then he's going to be stepping down, and he'll be in an advisory fashion and all. He will be joining us, as is our tradition, at 12:08 next Thursday to talk about all sorts of things Summerfest-related. But I bring this up because like I say, Summerfest is almost upon us, and this week we have been giving away four packs of Summerfest tickets each day, and since I didn't have a show yesterday, today we will be doing this twice, between now and 3 o'clock. Don't call right now. I'll tell you when. But between now and 3 o'clock, on two separate occasions, we will give away a four-pack of tickets to Summerfest. I say don't call now, and people are calling. No, I'll tell you when it is that you can call, but you have a chance to win tickets to Summerfest. And if you win them and you happen to come down during the noon to three period on any of the weekdays, be sure to stop off and say hello. All right, let's name names. Now, if you follow me on Twitter, which is at JeffWagner620, you know where I am going with this. Oh, by the way, as I always mention to people, there's all sorts of ways that you can find us, of course, over if you're listening over the radio or listening over the stream. We appreciate it. I keep seeing the podcast numbers. Lots of people are listening to the podcast. I very much appreciate that. But for the last month or so, we have a different feature. You can also watch the show, and a number of people do tune in to see how my wife Fran has dressed me on any given day. We have a YouTube channel. You just go to YouTube, WTM, put in WTMJ. And you'll see the live feed, or go to WTMJ.com and just click the watch live button, and you can watch all of the shows, including me, while we do spoken word radio. So you can check that out as well. Okay. So we start off the program, though, with two examples of let's go ahead and name the names. Let me start off with the one from yesterday. You may remember the off-duty Milwaukee police officer who was shot while trying to stop a robbery at the Shake Shack. All right, for those of you who aren't familiar with this, here's the deal. According to the criminal complaint, a DoorDash driver had a food order to pick up at a Shake Shack that was downtown. She parked her car outside the restaurant. She had her three children in the car with her. Once inside, the staff told her that someone was taking something out of her car. So the kids are in the car, she's in picking up the food, and somebody's going through her car. The complaint says the DoorDash driver saw a suspect running from her car and getting into a silver car that was stopped at the intersection. So somebody is stealing stuff out of one car, and then they're getting into a getaway car, right? When she went back out to her car, she found an iPhone that's in the car. And her daughter told her that the guy that was robbing the car had gotten into the front seat, looked back, said, oh, blank, when he noticed the children. All right, but the idiot leaves his iPhone in the car. The DoorDash driver goes back into the restaurant with the iPhone. At that point in time, guy who was trying to rob stuff out of the car walks in. The suspect demanded his phone and reached into the DoorDash driver's pocket to get it before he tried lifting her up to slam her to the ground. All right. A man in the Shake Shack then identified himself as a police officer. grabbed the suspect off the DoorDash driver and wrestled him to the ground. The DoorDash driver said she saw the suspect reaching for his waistband and that the store employees were yelling for her to get behind the counter. The DoorDash driver then started running, heard two gunshots, then a brief pause, then three additional shots. So you get the picture. You've got this guy who knows that he is dealing with an off-duty police officer who is trying to stop this attack, and the guy shoots the police officer. The detective suffered four gunshot wounds. He was released from the hospital 5 days after the shooting. That is the good news. All right. What happens is, after the guy shoots the police officer, runs out and jumps into the car, the getaway car. All right. Officers spotted the vehicle, tried to stop it near 27th and State. The chase stretched over 2 miles until near 29th and Burleigh, where three suspects then fled on foot in an alley after the vehicle crashed. The vehicle was stolen. So you get the idea. You've got the one guy who's shooting, who's like going through the car trying to steal stuff. And then you've got the getaway car that's waiting for him. And then all this other stuff happens. Okay, so I'm going through this. The one of the defendants is 19-year-old Deonte Hayes. He pled guilty last year to operating driving a vehicle without the owner's consent, stolen car, attempted car theft, and felony bail jumping. So he's one of the wheel guys. He's not the guy that shoots the officer, but he's involved in this incident that leads to an officer being shot and the robberies and stuff. It's a stolen car. They flee the police, et cetera, et cetera. So you might be thinking, all right, what would be an appropriate sentence for this particular situation? Well, okay, he's driving the stolen car, you're fleeing the cops, you've got all this stuff. If you were wondering what happened to him, the answer is probation. He was sentenced initially to 1 year of probation, but that sentence was stayed in favor of, wait for it, probation. He was put on probation for his involvement. And again, he's not the guy that pulled the trigger multiple times and tried to murder the police officer, but he is the guy that's driving the stolen car, fleeing from the police and running. He gets probation. In case you were wondering, because this is our name segment of the program, what judge in Milwaukee County thought it was a good idea to put this person on probation? That judge's name would be Michael Hanrahan. Michael Hanrahan, the Milwaukee County Circuit Judge, who thought probation was a good idea for this case. You can judge that. All right, I have another story. Again, if you follow me on Twitter, you're ahead of this. I want to tell you the story of Montrell Young, 33, initially charged with first-degree recklessly endangering safety, which was then chiseled. It was plea bargained down to intentionally pointing a firearm at a law enforcement officer. Here's his story. According to a criminal complaint, a plainclothes Milwaukee officer was in his unmarked squad car headed back to the police administration building, leaving a shooting scene June 12, 2021, almost 2 years ago. The officer sees a car speeding down 35th Street near North Avenue that passes his squad in the parking lane. The complaint says the driver disregarded a red light and collided with a minivan. Moments later, the car fled the scene. So you get this idea, car driving high rate of speed in the parking lane, goes through a red light, smashes into a minivan. The officer decided to search for the striking vehicle as it was leaking fluids and had front end damage. Near 39th and Garfield, the complaint states the officer heard two gunshots in close proximity to his location. He immediately slowed down, began to scan the immediate area to determine where the gunshots came from. Who's shooting at me? The officer spotted a man with shoulder-length dreadlocks emerged from a parked vehicle. Moments later, the officer spotted the same person standing in the doorway of an apartment complex, armed with a gun in his right hand. Well, nobody said this particular suspect was the sharpest knife in the drawer, but you get the idea. Shooting at the cops. The complaint says the officer locked eyes for a few seconds with the subject as he was looking over his right shoulder, looking out the rear passenger window directly at the suspect. That's when the officer observed the suspect raise the firearm in his right arm and discharge the firearm once in his direction. After the shot was fired, the suspect retreated into his apartment. Other officers were dispatched to the area. Officers visited multiple apartments, eventually found the guy who was identified as the person who shot at the police officer. They searched the apartment. They find ammunition, spent casing, cartridges, and multiple handguns. All right, this turns out to be Montreal Young. When questioned by investigators, he gave several various versions of events that included someone firing at him first, lie, and him seeing a suspicious SUV, lie. In another version, he said that there were just three shots fired during the incident, lie, and that he fired two of the shots himself. He also said he was only shooting to protect himself and his family and admitted to drinking that night. Okay, so you get the scene. Guy driving like a bat out of you-know-where in the parking lane, runs through a red light, hits a car. The police officer tries to pursue. The guy fires multiple shots at the police officer, then retreats into his apartment and ultimately has to be found. All right, shooting at a police officer, discharge of a firearm, you would think, what would be the appropriate penalty for that? Well, if you were wondering, again, the case was chismed. It was pled down from first-degree recklessly endangering safety, like trying to kill a police officer, to intentionally pointing a firearm at a law enforcement officer, which nevertheless is a felony, right? Carries up to 6 years in prison. So he shows up yesterday to be sentenced. Now, what do you think in a rational world would be an appropriate sentence for somebody who does what this guy did, including trying to kill a police officer? All right, few years in jail, right? Right? Now, even with the plea agreement, it's a maximum of 6 years. But you think, well, maybe 5 years because he tried to kill a guy or something like that. Well, if you thought 5 years, you would be wrong. If you thought 4 years, you would be wrong. If you thought 3 years, you would be wrong. Well, actually, here's what happened. The sentence, 3 years in prison, but sentence stayed, and the defendant put on probation for 3 years. You get probation for trying to murder a Milwaukee police officer. Probation. And now, I want to be fair here to the judge, the first 6 months of that probation is to be served in the Milwaukee House of Correction, or whatever they call it now, like the community, whatever they call it. House of Correction. 6 months. Now, you might ask me, and this is the question, if you follow me on Twitter, you know this. You might say, who is the Milwaukee County Circuit Judge who thought it was a good idea to put this guy on probation? And that, in our category of naming names, would be Milwaukee County Circuit Judge David Fice. The name David Fice sounds familiar. He's the same guy who dramatically lowered the bail on Daryl Brooks, he of the Waukesha Christmas Parade massacre. He's the guy who dramatically lowered the bail on Daryl Brooks, which led to the release of Daryl Brooks. So just two more examples of stuff that goes on a regular basis. Cases plea bargain down, and then once they're plea bargained down, judges that decide probation. The guy got probation for shooting at someone. Really? Now, he didn't hit him, and it was a plainclothes Milwaukee police officer. I guess maybe you can make the argument, well, he didn't know he was trying to shoot a murderer, a law enforcement officer. But at the same time, you shoot at people, and you do this, and you get probation. Welcome, and you wonder why things are out of control in Milwaukee County. We name names, and if you follow me on Twitter, we're going to continue naming names with some of these sentences. Back with more in just a minute. Tell you what, though. Right now, let's give away our first pair of Summerfest tickets. Our number, 855-616-1620. Caller number 10 wins a pair of tickets to Summerfest, which starts a week from today. We have a winner of our first four-pack of Summerfest tickets. We will be giving away another four-pack of tickets before the end of the program. So keep listening. You know, a number of people are number of people are expressing their outrage. What can we do about this? Well, you know, it's the judges you elect. Now, I should mention that David Feiss, who was the one who gave the probation to the guy who was shooting at the police officer, this is one of his sentences while going out the door. He is retiring, so, you know, he's going out the door, and this is how he chooses to go out the door, by... You can decide for yourself whether this type of stuff is appropriate. And I almost hate to single out some of these judges, because what they do is just typical of what happens so often in the Milwaukee County Courthouse. But if you wonder why we have these crime problems, okay, you take pot shots at a police officer after running through red lights and smashing into vans and things like that. You take pot shots at people and you get put on probation. Should we be surprised that we have a crime problem? And my answer would be no. Let me be self-indulgent here for just a moment. Something completely different. And again, I mentioned this if you follow me on Twitter. It's I wanted to say just thanks to everybody. This is I'm coming up on 25 years of doing the show, and one of the things that's kind of cool is that from time to time you get recognition for things. And Talkers Magazine, which is the it's kind of like, for our industry, it's kind of like Billboard or Variety would be. It covers the talk radio industry. And every year they come out with a list of 100 most influential talk show hosts. And that came out yesterday. And I'm always in the 90s. But this show was once again, and I was once again on the list. This is the ninth year in a row and the 10th in the last 11. Don't know what happened in 2014. But, I was one of two hosts. Mark Belling is the other who made this list and have consistently made the list. And I think, you know, basically, if you look at this, most of the people that make the list are from big markets and or nationally syndicated people or people who have shows on like satellite radio and stuff. And to make it, I mean, we're the 41st largest radio market, and to make it consistently, I think it's something I'm kind of proud of, at least. But it doesn't happen without you listening all this time. And so once again, I mean, thanks so much for listening. It's not like I get any extra money for things like this, but it does reach a certain point in your career where stuff like this makes a big difference. So once again, we made the list of the 100 most influential talk show hosts in America. It is subjective. It's arbitrary. I get all that. But it's still always nice to be on the list. So thanks again for listening, because if you don't listen, I don't get to make that list. I don't get to have the show. So I appreciate it very much. Well, this isn't good. Cheap Trick. Love the band Cheap Trick. I had purchased tickets. They were playing the first night of Summerfest. They were scheduled to play the first night of Summerfest at the BMO Pavilion. You know, not the main stage, but the BMO Pavilion, a great venue that overlooks the lake. I had even purchased tickets for some reserved seating, and they've just announced that they've canceled their Summerfest concert. Wow. That's too bad. Looking forward to that. Love Cheap Trick. Unforeseen circumstances is what they describe. Too bad. Okay. I first saw the story, credit where credit is due. I first saw this story on the website of Wisconsin Right Now, which is, it is a conservative-oriented website that does a really good job of breaking news. St. John Vianney, every year, and St. John Vianney it's a big church out in Brookfield, and they have a festival every year. I mean, and it's like, I don't know. It's like your typical church festival. It's located on Calhoun Road in Brookfield. And, you know, they've got, I think they still have rides, and they've got beer tents, and they've got all the stuff that goes on. They've got lots of music and stuff. And it's a very, very well-received and popular festival. All right. So here's the story. Go to a church festival, I guess, around here and get ready to, you know, like I said, forget your dancing shoes, bring your pepper spray and your cell phone. Here is the story. Four people were arrested. Two Brookfield police officers were hurt at the St. John Vianney Festival Saturday, June 10th. Brookfield police said officers were patrolling the event on foot and were either advised of or saw several fights take place. Officers intervened in a number of those fights. Four people arrested were a 21-year-old man, a 20-year-old man, a 15-year-old boy, and a 14-year-old boy. Okay, you're 14 years old, you go to a church festival, and you get involved in a fight that gets you arrested. Charges of disorderly conduct, resisting arrest, obstructing are being pursued. The officers were hurt while making the arrests. Police say one was taken to the hospital for treatment, was released. The other sought medical treatment the next day. So, I mean, Saturday night there's melees. The officers responded to an altercation that took place Friday. It was resolved without any arrests. Now, if you go to the website of Wisconsin Right Now, they have photos of this. And what you see is you have multiple fights that are breaking out. Video show an officer on the ground as people are continuing to fight. Two officers, like I say, injured, four that are under arrest. And that's just the beginning of this, because there's lots more fights. And if you watch this, you see people pulling hair. And the other thing that you see as you watch this is while the officers are trying to intervene and things like that, what is that one of the common elements? So you've got this fight that's breaking out in a church at church festivals. And what you see is that instead of trying to help out, instead of trying to, again, be a peacemaker, you see one person after another. You want to know what they do? I'll give you three guesses, but the first two don't count. Do they try to encourage the people to stop fighting? Hey, knock it off. No, they don't do that. Do they try to physically sort of break it up? Here, I'm going to grab one person. You grab the other. Let's try to separate them. Nope, they don't do that. What do? They pull out their cell phones and video the brawl. That's one of the striking things. If you look at the video from this that's on the Wisconsin Right Now website, it's people. Matter of fact, the videos show there's people videoing the people who are videoing the fight. Everybody's standing around with their cell phones filming the fight while the police are trying to intervene and trying to break this up. It's like, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're not going to help out. We're not going to try to play peacemaker. We're just going to sit there with the cell phones and try to watch it. Our number, 855-616-1620. That's the old National Bank talk and text line. Look, there's so many interesting aspects to this story. You go to a church festival and fights break out. You can't even go to a church festival in Brookfield nowadays without having people that come and start trouble, including young teenagers, and to the point that the trouble is so severe that you get police officers that get injured trying to break up the fight. So you got that aspect of the story going on. But I guess to me, the more interesting thing was that we don't intervene anymore. We just stand around and we record. We pull out the cell phones to watch the fights go on, waiting for somebody else to help out. Now, I understand that part of that is because maybe people, I don't know, maybe they're afraid that if I get involved, maybe I'm going to get punched out. Jeff, didn't you see what happened to the ex-Marine Daniel Penny? He just got indicted in New York for trying to restrain the aggressive, mentally ill person, you know, who was on that subway car. You know, we've talked about that story before. But I guess it's the standing around and the filming of stuff as opposed to trying to, I don't know, say something, trying to get involved, trying to stop people from getting hurt. Instead, we just video things. And I wonder if that really makes us a better society. 855-616-1620. Have you noticed this trend, and is it good? We discuss in a moment. Jeff, the festival is directly across from the Brookfield Police Headquarters, and officers all often hang out for public visibility relations. Shame on the disorderly attendees and on those opportunistic people who just stand by and post things online. Thank goodness no one pulled out a gun to settle the conflict, as too often happens. No question about it. Jeff, people won't intervene out of fear of getting hurt or charged like Daniel Penny in New York. Now he's in trouble because he did get involved. Well, that is the unfortunate thing from the Daniel Penny case. If we now have a situation where, you know, people, good people are afraid to intervene. They're afraid to help out the police who are involved in struggles. They're afraid, even if the cops aren't on the scene, they're afraid to try to intervene and break people up because they're concerned about liability. That is a very, very unfortunate sort of situation. Jeff, do you expect others to take a chance of getting shot or injured? Well, yeah, I mean, maybe sometimes that's it. So it's not just, hey, I'm not going to intervene, but it's the voyeur thing. I'm going to pull out my cell phone and I'm going to try to, you know, record this. I don't care if people kill themselves. I don't care if that police officer gets hurt. I'm just going to stand by because I want to end up running my videos. And that is just the reality of this. You know, whatever happened to the Good Samaritan? And I guess we know that answer. Jeff, St. John Vianney is a good festival. It's sad when knuckleheads cause problems that sometimes cancel or move the event. Example, you know, remember what happened to, you know, Greek Fest. You know, that's it. And one of our texters raises point. Jeff, normal people don't have qualified immunity. Why should we step in and possibly get sued or hurt? Institutionally protected to record people. It's freedom of the press. Well, okay. If you're standing at the festival and you've got a couple of kids that are like beating the heck out of each other and you've got an officer who's being wailed on because they're trapped in the middle of this and you decide that rather than trying to help out, you're just going to stand by and you're going to pull out your cell phone. First of all, you're not a member of the press, so get over that. Secondly, oh, it's constitutionally protected to record people. Oh, okay, yes and no, depending on where you're recording them. But that's not the point. The point is, isn't there a right and a wrong? And isn't there maybe, instead of just standing by and, hey, I'm going to video this because I'm going to put it up on my Facebook account and see how many clicks I get, isn't there at least some moral obligation to go there and to try to discourage someone from, hey, you know, break it up or get off that police officer? Or maybe if there's a couple of you trying to pull the kids that are fighting apart, or do we just let it become Lord of the Flies? And the truth is, we get the community we deserve. And if the attitude is going to be, oh, just, you know, who cares? You know, let them fight. Let's stand by. Let's watch the police officer. If that is collectively what our attitude is, well, it says, I think, a lot about us. And it says a lot about where our society is going, that good people just decide that they're going to sit by and record this stuff. Because, oh, it's cool. We're going to watch this. Look at this. You know, we'll post it online. And, oh, the police officer got hurt. Well, that's too bad. But you can't expect me to and my buddies to try to intervene and help break up a fight. No, let's just record it. You know, I understand you can make all these sort of arguments about it. Oh, well, they're afraid they might get sued. All right. But if you were being attacked, I mean, seriously, and that's the way I think you got to look at it. If you were being pummeled, if you're being robbed, you're being attacked in a public place, how do you feel if all the people around you, rather than coming to your assistance and rather than trying to help you, how do you feel if everybody just stands back, watches you being pummeled, and then just records it? I mean, is that really the society you want to live in? And for the people that are doing that, do you really feel good about yourself that was the decision that you made, that you weren't trying to discourage this, you were just standing by recording that? And if that was, if it was your kid, if it was your spouse, if it was your friend that found themselves in that situation getting beat upon or whatever, and everybody just kind of stood around and watched and videoed it, well, we can't be expected to get involved. And, you know, we can't be expected to try to separate the two. And we can't be expected to try to discourage this because, well, it's constitutionally protected to record people. It's freedom of the press. How would you feel? And is that really the community that we want to live in? But that's what's going on. And I guess, is it sad that you can't go to a festival put on by a church, you know, in Brookfield? Yes, it is very, very unfortunate without having to, you know, worry about, gee, is there going to be this fight that breaks out? Now, do I need to bring my pepper spray and things like that? Yeah, it's very, very sad. But it's also sad that the reaction of the crowd is to pull out your cell phone and video this instead of, oh, there's a police officer that got hurt in this struggle. Well, here, let me pull this out because, boy, you never know, that police officer might use excessive force, and then I want to be able to be the first one on whatever the TV news is saying, look at this type of thing. Let's just watch this. If it was you that that was happening to, would you want the crowd to react in that same way? And my guess is the answer is no. Join WTMJ Sandy Max and the American Red Cross for our WTMJ Cares event, the Milwaukee County Zoo Blood Drive. Donate blood during the three-day drive, Monday, June 26th through Wednesday, the 28th, to help boost the supply of necessary blood during the shortage. Plus, if you register for this event, receive free zoo admission and tickets to Summerfest. The Summerfest tickets are available while supplies last. For more information and to sign up, text BLOOD to 855-616-1620. It's the WTMJ Cares with our very own Sandy Max with the help of Gruber Law Offices. Yes, that is very, very cool. As a matter of fact, my lovely wife, Fran, said, I want to do that. So I said, well, this is how you do it. We'll sign up. So she's going to do this. I think everybody that has a chance should do that as well. It is a wonderful event, and we're thrilled that Sandy is involved in that. Okay, one of our texters says, Jeff, what you're talking about at the church festival where everybody stands around watching, it reminds me of the last Seinfeld episodes where, you know, nobody helped doing things. That's exactly right. Now, a couple of our texts are saying, okay, be honest, Jeff, are you getting involved in a fight to break it up? I highly doubt it. Maybe you won't pull out your phone and record it, but you aren't getting in the middle of it. No, I guess it depends on the circumstances. If there's a whole bunch of people standing around and you've got five or six or seven or eight people and there's two people that are just duking it out, I can see the group of people like trying to separate them. At the very least, maybe it's you, instead of just standing there and filming stuff, don't you have an obligation to go in and to say, okay, look, knock this off, stop doing this, stop fighting, try to break it up, as opposed to just, hey, you know, we've got this fight that's going on. This is one of the problems we have with all the violence in schools, that, you know, what happens with these school fights? When the fights break out, instead of people trying to do the right thing and trying to be peacemakers and trying to separate it, everybody pulls out their cell phones. Everybody starts videoing stuff. And then, you know, some people end up calling their relatives and saying, hey, you know, guess what? Charlie's in a fight. Get over here. And then you have all sorts of other people that come. And then, you know, you're just completely and totally off to the races with all this. It's a huge, huge problem. That is just the flat out reality of this. And I understand there's legal issues, and I understand there's all sorts of justifications for why you might just want to stand by and, you know, record the violence as it goes on. But I guess my point is this really the society that we want to live in? And if that is you, and again, who, you know, the fights are all sorts of different situations, but if you're in the process, you're at a church festival, and for whatever reasons, you've got a couple people that are pummeling you. You know, do you want people to try to help you, or do you want people to just stand by and watch you get pummeled? Okay, and if you're one of the people that say, well, I'm just willing, I want to watch people just stand by and pummel me. Oh, okay, that's fine. But I think most people don't necessarily feel that way. At least I hope most people don't necessarily feel that way. Hey, in the next hour of the program, lots of stuff coming up. God's way of telling you that you have too much money. A classic example, it comes from the world of sports. We're going to talk a little bit about some of the numbers of the makeup of the student body at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and a controversy that is surrounding this. And, of course, the elephant in the room now is the whole shared revenue thing. For years and years and years and years and years and years, Milwaukee County and the city of Milwaukee has been saying we need more money, in large part to bail them out from some very, very disastrous decisions that have been made over the years. Now that that bailout is on the horizon, there's some elected officials who are saying, never mind. We'll discuss all that. Don't go anywhere. This is Jeff Wagner.
Live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's the Jeff Wagner Show. Now, here's WTMJ's Jeff Wagner.
And you're listening to the Jeff Wagner Show. Jeff stepped out for a moment. I'm not sure if he's watching golf or what he's doing, but just wanted to make sure he got back in here at 107. Too busy. So much going on a day, so I just wanted to make sure that you are aware that he is coming back into the studio. I was worried about you there for a buddy. Wasn't sure what was happening. I'm glad you're okay.
Well, no, I'm okay. Here's the... I don't know. This is kind of inside, but nobody cares about this. I was on the phone with the Social Security Administration.
Oh, okay. Yeah, sure. It sounds riveting.
Well, it's one of these frustrations and by the way, I'm a fan of the Social Security Administration. People complain about, well, you know, I've actually had very, very good responses. Mm-hmm. And I was just talking to the guy. He says, your situation never comes up. That's exactly right. It's like, I'm like, really? You know, you never want to hear that. And it had to do with a benefit claim and things like that. But we've got it all worked out.
I think history was made. Just now, by the way, I have worked with you for a long time.
20 plus years, right?
I don't think I have ever in the history of sharing a studio with you been done with a newscast.
And I wasn't there. Charlie came out and said, I was on the phone with the Social Security Administration, and I could have waited till after the show, but I got this call, okay, so here's the other thing. All right, this is kind of like, I'm putting in a claim for survivor's benefits because of my late wife.
Mm-hmm,
and
okay,
so,
sure.
And there's only certain times you can do it and stuff. And it's kind of, so the first thing was, so I had like a 30 minute interview like a week or so ago. And, they told me that I needed a marriage license. Do you have your marriage license?
I'm sure we have it somewhere.
Don't be so sure. I didn't have our marriage license.
Really?
I mean, I had a certificate that the minister signed and stuff.
Considered a license.
That's not a license. No, you need a certified copy from wherever the county is.
So the courthouse where you originally would have gone.
Right, you have to do that. So I was saying, okay, the fact that we filed joint tax returns for 25 or 30 years, that doesn't matter. Nope. That doesn't matter. That started me down this road of getting the certified marriage license, which is you could do it. You know, there's no question. I was trying to do it. I was trying to do it from avoiding to have to go to the courthouse for a variety of reasons. So I got that accomplished. So I was so happy. I sent that in and they acknowledged that they have that and they're processing. And then again, it's never a good thing when they're saying, this never comes up. I had to take it to my boss and we had to do this. And he was trying to explain this rule to me. And I was like, this doesn't make any sense to me, but I get it. I mean, whatever. Bottom line was, I thought I was going to get some money sooner than I am.
That's what we've learned. Okay.
That's the bottom line. But thank you for taking that up. That is exactly right. Where could Jeff be? All right. Nobody cares about that. Let's get back into the pro. This is the type of stuff. It is why that Talkers Magazine lists me as one of the most 100 influential talk show hosts year after year.
That's right.
It is that kind of stuff. Okay, God's way of telling you that you have too much. Eric, stay here for just a second. Okay. How much money would it take for you to forego, let's say that you've got a vacation or something.
Okay.
Okay, you got a vacation or something. But if you were to forgo your vacation, somebody wanted you to do something. Somebody wanted to hire you for something, you know? And so you had other plans, but they were going to pay you a bunch of money. How much money would it take? And I understand it's a tough question, but.
Well, I guess I'd want to cover whatever I paid for the vacation.
Yeah. Okay.
So at least that plus, hey, my time is valuable.
Right.
So I'd say $10,000.
$10,000. Okay, fair enough. Right, ten grand. Okay, you change your plans and go in there. All right. Okay, this is the story. Takeaways from the Green Bay Packers minicamp practice on Tuesday. So it's about, you know, the minicamp is going on.
Yep.
And as often happens with stories, buried in the story is what I find to be the most interesting part. Jair Alexander is you know, the all-pro cornerback for the, do you know where I'm going with this?
I do. Go ahead.
He's the all-pro cornerback for the Packers. Rasul Douglas, another cornerback for the Packers. They were at these mini camps because this mini camp was mandatory. And if they hadn't showed up, they would be subject to being able to be fined like stupid money, you know, like $9,000 a day or something like that if they don't show up. But here's the interesting thing. They skipped voluntary workouts. There were a couple voluntary mini camps. Alexander shows up at the mandatory mini camp. He lost out on a $700,000 workout bonus because he didn't go to the voluntary mini camps. Rasul Douglas, another starting cornerback, also skipped the voluntary work, foregoing a $300,000 bonus. And here's the even weirder part about this. Alexander said he stayed in Green Bay for most of the offseason until about April and then left to work out on his own just as the Packers' offseason program was kicking in. I don't even know what to say about this.
You walked away from $700,000.
Right.
Easy money.
It's not like the guy's in Tahiti for the off. I mean, he's in Green Bay. He's working out. Then the time for the mandatory, the optional mini camps roll around. He doesn't have to be there, but they've got a bonus in there. $700,000. Not $7, not $70, not $700, not $7,000, $700,000 for just showing up for a couple of these things, and he chose not to. Now, it's his right not to do it, but he walked away, Eric, from $700,000.
That is life-changing money for a lot of people.
It's just, there's this whole other, and then the other guy walked away from $300,000. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's just, you almost don't know what to say about this type of stuff. And I just, it just shows you, again, whether it's God's way of telling you that you have too, I mean, it really is God's way of telling you that you have too much money if you can walk away right. from 700 grand, right?
Part of me respects it, I guess, that they're not just penny pinchers saying, oh, I'm going to suck every dime from the Packers.
Did you hear what you just said? That they're not penny pinchers? It's $700,000. Seriously.
I don't know.
Well, it just tells you, it is kind of this disconnect between the world of the rich and famous and these professional athletes and things like that and ordinary people who would say, gee, for 700 or 7,000 or whatever, $700,000, right. And you just walk away from it.
Yeah.
All I know is I don't want to see a story 20 years from now about how Jair Alexander is like down on his luck and the money's gone because, you know, he walked away from $700,000.
He could have been $700,000 richer. See, yeah, I'm with you.
But that's it. God's way of telling you that you have too much money if you can walk away from $700,000. But he's back for the mandatory minicamps because you don't want to get fined $10,000 a day or whatever that is. When we come back. All right, are they not taking enough in-state students? Stick around. One of our texters, good grief, Charlie Brown. I've been working Sundays for an extra $600. What's wrong with this picture? Well, it does, again, show how out of whack some stuff gets that you and I understand, like in the Packers deal, they want the players to work out, and so it's optional, but they put in incentives. And it's about as easy as $700,000 as Jair Alexander could have possibly made, simply, especially since he was staying in Green Bay in the offseason, to simply say, okay, I'm going to go into these voluntary workouts and I'm going to walk away with $700,000. And you decide, nah, I'm going to go work out somewhere else. Wow. It's never going to happen in my lifetime, but I wish you. I guess the best I wish for you is that you get into a situation where you are in a position in life where you can just turn your nose up at $700,000. Charlie, producing the show today and always, that is my wish for you, that sometime over the course of what I'm sure is going to be a long and successful radio career and media, my fondest wish is to you that you can walk away with $700,000, just say, $700,000. It's that's just chicken feed. Who needs this? Okay. I was talking earlier about this website, Wisconsin Right Now. And that's where I saw some of the photos of the fight that happened out, the various fights that happened out in Brookfield. And while I was looking at their website, they had a really, really interesting posting that caught my attention. And actually, this isn't necessarily new information, but it started going back to, I think it was 2021. Starting in 2021, for the first time, the incoming class, the number of students at UW-Madison, not the whole UW system, but UW-Madison, the number of in-state students represented 46% of the students who were entering as freshmen. What that means is more out-of-state students and international students, now they combine the two, are being enrolled at UW-Madison than in-state students. And this has been, you know, going on for at least a couple of years now. Now, what creates the controversy is that you have a number of people who apply to UW in-state, you know, whose parents have been paying, you know, taxes for years and years and years to help subsidize the state. And the kids that apply, you know, really, really good grades, 4.0 grades, high scores on the SAT or the ACT or whatever that is, and they end up getting waitlisted. Now, what happens is a practical matter is a lot of these students end up going to another UW school. Maybe they go to UW La Crosse, Stevens Point, whatever. And then what happens is if they want to get into Madison, they get into Madison a year from now or 2 years from now because people that enroll as freshmen end up transferring or dropping out or whatever, and it creates vacancies. So it's just because you get waitlisted or don't get in as a freshman doesn't mean that you can't get in the future. But nevertheless, it's frustrating. And the issue that is coming up is this whole idea that in the state of Wisconsin, more than half of the students who are admitted to UW as freshmen are not in-state students. Now, UW will say, well, we've got a guarantee. We guarantee that at least 3,600 students, you know, are going to be from Wisconsin. And they say that, you know, our percentages of acceptance, well, you know, it's still tougher if you're an out-of-state student to get in than an in-state student because of the number of applications we get. But it doesn't change the fact that you have more out-of-state and international students who are being admitted than in-state students. Now, part of the answer is money, because if you are an out-of-state student, you pay dramatically more in tuition than if you are an in-state student. Okay, that's just the reality. So UW makes more money by bringing in the out-of-state student than if they take the student from here. However, the out-of-state student's parents haven't been paying Wisconsin taxes, maybe for 10 or 20 or 30 or 40 years, supporting the university. Our number is 855-616-1620. That is the old National Bank talk and text line. Okay, let's tee this up. And for those of you who might have had kids or grandkids that have gone through this, should UW-Madison be taking more in-state students? What do you think? We discuss in just a moment. 855-616-1620. That is the old National Bank talk and text line. Up until 2015, there was a cap on the number of UW-Madison students who could be from out of state. You couldn't have more than 27.5% of couldn't have more than that came from out of state, and that included international. That cap was eliminated in 2015, and what's happened is more and more out of state, and I'm rolling in international students in that way, have been admitted, and now it's more than half. More than half of the students who are admitted come from out of state, which means their parents haven't paid you know, Wisconsin state taxes for years and years and years. Now, the tuition is more. 855-616-1620. Jeff, my daughter is in the process of applying for college. On paper, she's a perfect candidate for UW-Madison. She's a 4.0 student, high ACT scores, and involved in extracurricular activities. She doesn't have a chance to get accepted to Madison, though, because she is an in-state student, she is a non-minority, and she comes from a middle-class family. It's really disappointing because we would love to keep our money in the state. She's now looking at schools in Florida and Texas where they would love to take our money. The reality is that UW-Madison wants the out-of-state tuition, and they want diversity. Well, there's nothing wrong with diversity in and of itself, but at the same time, how is it fair to all the families who have been supporting UW over the years with their tax dollars? How is it fair to say, okay, we're now perfectly qualified in-state student, but we don't want them because we want to get more because there's the money? 855-616-1620. Larry in West Bend. Larry, you're on WTMJ. Good afternoon.
Hey, Jeff. How are you?
Good. What do you think?
I think that we really need to look at this at a big a macro level. One of the roles of the university is to train the next generation of workforce, with the technologies that exist and the technologies that are being developed. So we have an able workforce that can go into our businesses and help them thrive. And if all we're doing is training students from out of state or out of the country, those people are going to go back to their states and their countries with that knowledge. And the students that we have in our state are going to be at a deficit because they didn't get that experience.
Well, right. Plus, we've driven, okay, like in the example that I was just giving, you got this person who texted me. You know, the daughter's a 4.0 student, wants to stay in Wisconsin, but now we're driving her to, Florida, Texas, wherever. You know, who's to say that she's going to come back to Wisconsin after that? You know, it's really kind of a crapshoot.
Absolutely. If you look at these kids, if they excel, they're going to get internships from businesses that are in the community surrounding these universities, and those are going to result in offers for employment, and those kids are gone. So we're sending our best and brightest to go somewhere else in the name of like you said, diversity or
money.
The fukes we might make.
Right, short term.
On their tuition for a couple of years?
Yeah.
It's very short-sighted.
Yeah, no, thanks for calling. It is extremely short-sighted. That's predictable. Now, a number of people are texting saying, Jeff, it's all about the money. Yeah, I get it. I understand that it's all about the money. But at some point in time, does that make sense? Have we gone too far where we say, okay, it's now more than 50% of the people enrolling at UW-Madison are from out of state? We're going to continue this for one more segment. Our number is 855-616-1620, which is the old National Bank talk and text line. Back with more calls and texts in just a moment. So Cheap Trick is not coming.
No.
No, I had tickets. I had tickets to that show. And one of the reasons I did, but this is just got a notice from Ticketmaster saying show has been canceled. You don't have to do anything. We're sending you charge it. We're sending the money back to your credit card.
Yeah, that's it's disappointing for fans who wanted to see Cheap Trick. I guess sometimes the flame does go out.
Very clever. Very clever. When we come back, we continue our conversation. There are now more out-of-state students being admitted as freshmen to UW-Madison than in-state students. Is that right? Stick around. Jeff, my daughter is a 4.3 grade point average, high, which I assume because of like advanced placement, that's how you get over a 4-point GPA. My daughter is a 4.3 GPA, high ACT score, involved in sports and volunteerism. Last year, UW-Madison was the only college out of the 12 colleges that she applied for that she did not get into. She was accepted into at colleges such as Syracuse University, Marquette, Loyola, Xavier, Kentucky, South Carolina, and at the University of Tennessee, where she is currently enrolled. There were students from her high school that got into Madison with a 3-point grade average, but they were of a different ethnicity to her. Maybe on the application, she should have identified as someone she's not, then maybe she would have had a chance at getting into this college. By the way, I'm very happy with the choice, would never want to get into UW now. Well, the whole affirmative action issue in the name of diversity is a whole different story. But I want to kind of focus right now on the idea that this is, we are sowing what we reaped. In 2015, the legislature lifted the requirement that essentially three-quarters of the incoming freshmen at UW-Madison had to be from in-state. And because out-of-state students paid dramatically more money, there's dramatically more out-of-state students that are now being admitted, which is all well and good. But at the same time, you've got very, very qualified kids who've grown up in Wisconsin, who want to go to UW-Madison, who cannot get in or are being turned away. And so all that money, mom and dad, that you paid in taxes for the 18 years that you were living here, in that example, and I understand some people move in differently, all that money that you've been putting in to support the UW system and UW-Madison, well, it doesn't matter. Now, I understand the alternative is you say, okay, well, the kid can't get into Madison, but she really wants to go, so we'll send him to La Crosse or Eau Claire or Stevens Point or somewhere else. And then, you know, after a year or two, as other people start to drop out, maybe they'll be able to transfer in. But that's not, that's especially for the best students. My guess is that's not what's happening. It's what I'm seeing on all these texts where the kids decide, okay, we're going to go out of state. And the concern mom and dad are having is the kids are never going to come back. Let's talk to Rick in Illinois. Rick, you're on WTMJ.
Yeah, thanks for having me, and I'm really enjoying your discussion. So a couple of things real quickly. I'm a college professor. I won't say which college I'm at, but I'm also a graduate of Madison back in 1985. One of the ways that parents can get around not getting your student into UW-Madison is depends on which program they pick. So in other words, if you want to get into engineering, they'll look at not just your GPA, but also the kind of classes that you excelled in. So if you don't think you're going to be getting into the engineering program, apply to liberal arts. Go for something smaller. Go for something less strenuous on your academic transcript from high school, and then transfer within once you get into UW-Madison. That's a real good trick of the trade. The other thing is, when I was in school, the engineering campus, which is right next to the meteorology building where I went to school, literally, you needed a 3.5 GPA if you were an out-of-state engineering student. If you were in-state, it was 3.0.
Right.
So they did favor in-state students because they didn't want to have basically 90% of the engineering students literally coming from not only out-of-state but also internationally as well.
Right.
So that was one way back then that they did that. Another thing, and this is the last thing I'll talk about, and then you can comment on the other side of this, but even though I was a very well-giving alumni for almost 15 years, by the time my son decided to apply to UW-Madison, I thought I was going to get some sort of tuition remission because as an alumni, I gave a lot of money.
Right.
He said, nope, not happening anymore. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. I've been giving a fair amount of money over literally enough. It probably would have taken care of 2 years of tuition. They said, nope, no longer. I said, well, I don't think I'm going to be given at this level anymore. They go, why? I go, because part of this was also to show you that I was really endeared towards the college. So, again, there's a lot of tricks out there
right.
that the parents can get into, and I'm not too sure why this particular student didn't get in, but I think it may have to do with the program that she kind of lasered herself into. So, again, one of the ways you do, you go a little bit lower and hopefully transfer once you get into the actual university.
Right. Now, thanks. I appreciate it. I appreciate that there's all the tricks of the trade and things like that. That I guess part of the frustration, though, I think that in-state – and I am not arguing, by the way, that you dumb down – the qualifications. But at the same time, it's very apparent that there seems to be preferences that are being given because of the revenue thing to out-of-state students. And at some point in time, you wonder if this balance gets out of whack. Now, I get it. And everybody's texting me saying, Jeff, don't you understand? It's all about money. Yeah, I get it. I understand out-of-state students pay more. And so there is an incentive to take the out-of-state students over in-state students, simply because they generate more revenue. And that's all well and good. But if you've got qualified in-state students who are being told no, because we'd rather have the money from the out-of-state students, There's something wrong with that, in my opinion, especially since we taxpayers, those of us who are in-state residents, are subsidizing with our state taxes the UW system. And I think, look, and I understand it's a difficult situation, and I don't know, like I say, before 2015, the numbers were about three-quarters of the incoming freshmen had to be from the state. Okay, maybe you can argue that that's out of whack. Maybe you can argue that in the interest of just geographical diversity, if nothing else, there is an incentive to having it there be more of a balance. Like we need to get more coasties in there. Isn't that the phrase they still use? We need to get more of the coasties in. Okay, and I understand that you can make that argument, but at the same time, doesn't there need to be some sort of preference for those families whose kids are otherwise qualified and are supporting and have been supporting the UW system for years and years, and especially if the goal is getting into UW-Madison. And by the way, like I say, I understand, as we were talking about earlier, one of the other ways around this is you enroll somewhere else, and then you transfer in. I know that there's a number of people who do that. But at the same time, if your goal is, hey, I don't want to be bouncing around to different colleges. I want to go because I want the four-year college experience, and I want to be a freshman at UW-Madison. Gianni in Montello, you're on WTMJ. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Jeff. Hey, great topic. Hey, listen, based on your last caller, it's unfortunate, though, that students have to resort to hijinks to get into the Madison campus. Let me throw a number at you. 80% should be Wisconsin residents. I've been paying taxes since 1984. And if we want out-of-state students or foreign students, and believe me, I had great experiences with foreign students at Stevens mm-hmm. Point back in the day. But let them go to, Eau Claire, the satellite, River Falls, Oshkosh, Stevens Point, the satellite colleges, and let the best and the brightest of Wisconsin get into Madison. Because, you're graduating this year, last week, and you should be on the top of the list because your parents have been subsidizing this for decades.
Yeah, Gianni, thanks. Well, I think that's the argument, and that's what the thinking always was prior to 2015. And again, I don't know. You're throwing 80%. It was 75%. I don't know if that's the right percentage. But we are now at a point where the University of Wisconsin-Madison has become at least as far as incoming freshmen go, it has become a majority out-of-state school. there's more kids from out-of-state than there are from in-state. Think about that. Attending, and when I say out-of-state, again, I'm including the international students, but there's more out-of-state, out-of-country students that are attending the flagship, that are admitted to the flagship university of the state of Wisconsin, which is underwritten by taxpayers of the state of Wisconsin. There's more out-of-state, out-of-country students than there are in-state. There's something wrong with that. And whether it's the desire for diversity, which I don't have a problem with in and of itself, whether it's geographical or ethnic or whatever that might be, or it's just a plain old desire that, hey, we're going to get more money from the out-of-state students. Where are our tax dollars going? And is that really a good priority? And is it short-sighted? Questions to think about. It feels like summer, which means the big show is almost upon us. That would be Summerfest. This week, all week, we've been giving away a set of four Summerfest tickets every day. Today, we've been giving away two four-packs. All right, to help get you ready for the occasion, Summerfest starts a week from today. I'll be broadcasting live from the lakefront every weekday. I have another four-pack of tickets to give away. Caller number 12. Caller number 12 at 855-616-1620. That's the old National Bank talk and text line. Caller 12 wins a four-pack of tickets to Summerfest. And if you happen to be down there a weekday between noon and 3, stop off and say hello. Say hello, even if you aren't the winner of the tickets. I would love to see that. All right. This is going to be largely a Donald Trump-free day on the program because I think a lot of the stuff has been said. But there are two interesting stories. And as I've talked about this whole Trump indictment, and again, I understand there are people who think, oh, just lock him up, and there's other people who think it's a witch hunt and things like that. The two things that are amazing, the thing that, again, continues to amaze me the most about this is the fact that this was all so avoidable. There's a big story in the Washington Post that talks about how apparently there were his lawyers were begging him to just give these documents back. And they had all sorts of strategies that could have made this whole thing go away. And he didn't. And so it's like, it just still boggles my mind that you find yourselves in this situation. There is a piece in the Wall Street Journal today by Karl Rove. I want to read a portion of it. I rarely read entire articles because I'm not sure that's the greatest radio in the world, but it's behind a paywall. And I wanted to share this. And this is, of course, Karl Rove, who was the architect of the George W. Bush campaigns. America has been plunged into an unprecedented crisis by the indictment of Donald Trump on various felony counts. Unlike the charges from the Manhattan District Attorney, this indictment is devastating in its rigor of evidence and the seriousness of the alleged crimes. Even so, the case will further tear our country apart, as it has a heavy impact on the presidential campaign and wrongly undermines confidence in our justice system. The blame for this calamity rests solely on Mr. Trump and his childish impulse to keep mementos from his time in the Oval Office, no matter what the law says. And then it goes through the Presidential Record Act, which says the U.S. shall reserve and retain complete ownership, possession, and control of presidential records. Okay, so it goes through all this. And then it says, you know, so in the face of this, Trump leaves Washington in January of 2021. He orders a fleet of trucks to carry away hundreds of boxes of letters, reports, memos, and other documents he'd received as president. The indictment says these included information about the defense and weapons capabilities of both the U.S. and foreign countries, American nuclear programs, our and our allies' potential vulnerabilities to military attack, and plans for possible retaliation to an attack. Those documents, this is Karl Rove writing, those documents didn't belong to Mr. Trump, and he surely knew that. The president's lawyers and his staff must have warned him he couldn't take the files. His top aides with security clearance have been made well aware of the classified document sensitivity, having all signed acknowledgments that they weren't allowed to disclose it. It may have been also explained to Mr. Trump that the White House Office of Records Management kept a list of the documents he received, and the National Security Council maintained a log so people would know if he took them. That's why in May of 2021, the archives began requesting their return. When Mr. Trump sent some records back in January of 22, the archives knew he had more. When his lawyer said in June of 22 that after a diligent search, all remaining documents had been returned, the FBI knew it wasn't true. It took a search warrant 2 months later to collect them. Mr. Trump says there's no criminal penalty for violating the Presidential Records Act. That's true. But it only highlights how damning his behavior was. Congress thought a law so simple and clear would be honored by anyone entrusted with the presidency. Instead of living up to his office, Mr. Trump treated it and America's national security flippantly, taking thousands of presidential records, among them hundreds of highly classified documents. It should have been evident to anyone who once occupied the Oval Office that documents containing some of the nation's most important secrets shouldn't be treated as trophies, shared with private guests, discussed with political associations, or stored in bathrooms or ballrooms. Any staffer found guilty of this would go to prison for breaking the laws protecting the nation's secrets, as Mr. Trump is now charged. And so then, you know, Rove goes on to talk about how bad this is for the country and things like this. And he concludes by saying, extreme as the situation is, it could have easily been avoided if Mr. Trump had simply followed the law and left behind his precious keepsakes. It's a shame one of his top aides didn't have the gumption to make him do so. If then White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows ordered the trucks heading south to Mar-a-Lago to detour to drop off records at the archives warehouse in Maryland, it might have enraged Mr. Trump when he found out, but it would have spared the country from the ugly months ahead. No matter the outcome, America will pay a high price for the former president's reckless petulance. So will he. I agree with everything. You know, Karl Rove has just written. And again, regardless of whether or not you believe that Trump is, oh, lock him up and this is the worst thing in the world, or whether you think it's a witch hunt, it's all so completely unnecessary. Everybody knows, including Donald Trump, that you know he didn't have a right to take these records. And once that was pointed out, this whole problem would have been avoided if he just simply returned the records. No indictment, no jail time, no arraignment, no perp walk, no controversy. But now we're plunged into this controversy because Donald Trump, as an architect of chaos, thought that he was just above the law. Now, I don't know if he's going to be convicted of this or not, but as I said before, it's bad for the country, but it's a completely self-induced injury. It is unfortunate that it's come to this, but you really, Mr. Trump has nobody but himself to blame. All right, when we come back after the top of the hour news, lots of stuff coming up. I want to discuss the shared revenue bill. I want to discuss the latest developments on a new concert venue in Milwaukee. And I want to talk about something called the three-month rule and whether you believe it. All that's coming up after the top of the hour news. This is Jeff Wagner.
Live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's the Jeff Wagner Show. Now, here's WTMJ's Jeff Wagner.
Good afternoon, Wisconsin. Welcome back to the show. So very glad to have you with us. You might remember a few months ago, huge debate that had started up over these plans that FPC Live, which is a Madison-based subsidiary of Live Nation. Live Nation is a dominant player in the concert industry. And the plan was that, I'm going to call it Live Nation, but it's FPC Live, which is a subsidiary. But if you remember, the Bradley Center site, the old Bradley Center, which has been torn down, next to Fiserv, the plan was that Live Nation was going to build a concert venue next to Fiserv. And this would be a venue where you could put like 3,500 people in it. It was going to be that size. It was going to be that would be the capacity, the music venue that would be there. So it would be suitable for entertainers, bands, you know, performers who can't fill Fiserv, but who nevertheless have a following that kind of, I mean, I'm not going to insult people. I don't mean it's mid-level if you can draw 3,500, but there's some bands that can fill a 17,000 seat arena. There's others that, you know, draw 3,500. Now, originally they wanted to build this facility down by where the Summerfest headquarters are. And you had some of the neighbors and some of the neighboring concert venues that didn't want the competition, and so they ended up killing that. So the plan was, let's move it, let's build it by the Bradley Center. I thought that was an absolutely perfect location for it. Now, again, a lot of the competitors were saying, well, you can't do that because if you do it, it'll be a monopoly, and we're not going to be able to book bands at our venues, and it's going to put us out of business, etc. What happened is there needed to be a zoning change. But once the operators made a commitment that essentially it was going to be built by all union labor and staffed by all union labor, any objections to the zoning changes kind of went away. So if you've been wondering what's happening with that, because the original plan was to get the thing built before the Republican National Convention. Well, there's a really interesting piece on Urban Milwaukee, which, just like Wisconsin right now, is one of these websites that cover the city. And you might have noticed that even though this zoning change was approved over 6 months ago, and even though the plans were that this thing was supposed to have ground was supposed to have been broken as early as December of last year, and this facility would have been opened maybe by July of 2024, there's been no groundbreaking. No groundbreaking in December or January, nothing at all. And now there appears to be real questions about what's going on with this. The project, the costs have dramatically increased. Originally, it was going to be $50 million, and now because construction costs are going up, that estimate is raising. In addition, they don't want... Because the Republican National Convention is going to be at Fiserv in the summer of next year, they don't want they don't want that to be ground under repair. You know, you don't want to be in the middle of a massive construction project with cranes and all this other stuff when you've got the convention here. So to the extent that there is ever a groundbreaking, it's probably not going to be until after the summer of 2024 at best. So any building project probably can't start until August of 2024 as a practical matter, which means even if it happens, then it takes over a year, probably a year and a half to build it. So you're probably looking at the earliest at late 2025 or, you know, 2026. In the meantime, and Urban Milwaukee, the website, points this out, construction costs are increasing and financing for a lot of these public facilities like this, these concert venues, it's tougher. It's tougher to clear this. On top of that, there was also a plan. Remember in this proposed Iron District where they wanted to put the they wanted to put the soccer stadium. Remember there was a plan to like put a similar 3,500 capacity music venue there. That's pretty much all but dead. As a practical matter, that's pretty much all but dead. So it looks like, you know, when we were talking months ago, you know, could you support two extra 3,500 seat music venues? And I think I didn't believe that you could, but there was that argument about it. Now the question is, are any of these venues really going to occur? Now, the people that are pushing this location that was supposed to be in the Bradley Center site are saying, well, we're going to do this. Something's ultimately going to get done. It might just not get done for a couple years. Our number is 855-616-1620. That's the old National Bank talk and text line. I think this raises what to me is one of the more interesting questions about, you know, live music and entertainment and things like that. There are a lot of different entertainment venues around here for a city our size. You've got the Summerfest Grounds. You've got the BMO Amphitheater that's down there. You've got Fiserv. You've got a number of other smaller venues that are here as well, the clubs and things like that. I guess the question that this brings in, like I say, a year ago, we were talking about two 3,500-seat music venues. One is pretty much definitely off the table. And if you read the tea leaves, I think it would be fair to say that the other proposed venue is on life support. Not saying it's not going to happen, but if it happens, it's not going to be for a few years, and time is not on the side of the project, like I say, because costs continue to increase, financing continues to become a huge issue. Not saying it can't be done, but it's these projects, they don't generally age like fine wine, and the longer they get deferred and the longer they get delayed, the more difficult it is to make it happen. My question is, can our area, in southeastern Wisconsin in general, and Milwaukee in particular, do you believe we can support another 3,500-seat music venue to justify the, I don't know, $50-plus million? Now it's going to be a lot more than that. Does it make economic sense? Do you think it's going to happen? 855-616-1620. That's the old National Bank talk and text line. I thought we could support one, but the longer time goes on, the more questioning I have about whether or not it's going to really happen. What do you think? 855-616-1620. We discuss in a moment. Jeff, I think there are more places needed because some of them are only available during the warm weather months. Fiserv shows are often pricey. Well, right, that's true, but that's generally speaking, it's because of the nature of the entertainment that Fiserv is bringing. The rave is a dump. Rave is such a dump, this is what our texter says. I think I marked myself safe on social media the last time I got home from a show there. I would like to see a venue bigger than the Pabst, Miller, or Riverside, but not as pricey as Fiserv. And, of course, you know, you've got AmFam Field that books like the really big stadium shows. I mean, that is part of the issue that you do. You have the Pabst Theater. You have, the Miller Theater, the old Milwaukee, you know, auditorium. You've got the Riverside. You've got the Rave. You've got these other venues that are there. And you have a limited population that's out there. Jeff, I'm a concert junkie. I'd love Milwaukee for all the venues they have, the Pabst, Riverside, Miller High Life, Rave, Shank Hall, BMO, and AmFam, not to mention Fiserv and AmFam Field. Yeah, see, that is the issue that they run into. And I thought and continue to believe that if you can get it at the right price, building this venue, I thought that the location right next to Fiserv for another concert venue that'll Bradley Center site, that's right off of the Deer District, to me that made sense. So what they were talking about up at the Iron District, which is off of Michigan, to the extent that that's, now that the state isn't contributing money to build the soccer field, I don't know that that's going to happen. I think the plans to build a hotel there are kind of on hold. All you have now, right, that's going ahead, at least at this point in time, is some subsidized housing. That location never made any sense to me for a 3,000, you know, person venue. The spot, you know, next to at the Bradley Center site, I always thought was the perfect spot because, again, you have the Deer District right there. You've got all the parking that's all set up. You've got all the restaurants and stuff just to the south of the Deer District, you know, 3rd Street and all that type of stuff. So, I mean, I thought it was a perfect venue. But here's just the reality. If you start off, you know, with a budget that says, okay, we're going to try to get this done, and we think we can get this done at $50 million, and then all of a sudden you get delays and delays and delays, and you don't do the groundbreaking and all those things, and now costs rise, and now you're looking at maybe it's not $50 million anymore, maybe it's $60 million, and we're having trouble, like, arranging the financing because some banks don't want to touch, you know, things like this, and we're not going to be able to be open and have events in time for the run-up to the Republican National Convention, and we're not going to be able to be building it, you know, before the convention occurs. So now, you know, our opening date is probably, best case scenario, going to be a year and a half or two years later. You get to a certain point where it just, you wonder what the critical mass of this is. Jeff, I think they should let it die. I never thought it made any sense anyways, especially being built right next to the underutilized, similar-sized Miller High Life Theater, the Wisconsin Center Auditorium, that was funded by tax dollars. Yes, Jeff, if Milwaukee wants to be a big city, then smaller music venues are needed, and it will be used. These venues can be used for more than just music. Look at Minneapolis-St. Paul, for an example of a booming downtown and university area. Well, I think it would be used. I would like to see it, but the fact that they haven't broken ground and now probably aren't going to be able to, best case scenario, you know, break ground for, well, at least a year, over a year, probably closer to a year and a half, which delays the opening, you know, another 6 months, 8 months, a year. The longer this goes on, the less likely this becomes. And I got to admit, I'm a little bit surprised because I thought once the Common Council made that zoning change, I thought it was going to be full speed ahead. Turns out not to be the case. So, very glad to have you with us. A couple, I don't know if it would be fair to say obscure, but a couple interesting passings. Cormac McCarthy, I don't know how many people know him, a very famous author. Perhaps, you know, one of the most famous and accomplished authors that maybe a lot of people haven't heard about. He passed away at the age of 89. I'm a huge fan of Cormac McCarthy. Maybe his best known work, well, All the Pretty Horses, which was, they made it a movie. It was a 1992 book, and they made it a movie in 2000 with Matt Damon, about a couple of young cowboys who ride into Mexico. Interesting story. Maybe that might be his most famous book. He's probably best known for the Oscar-winning movie No Country for Old Men, which was an incredibly good movie. I've read the book. Like, last year, for some reason, somebody recommended me to read the book, and actually the book, I think, is better than the movie. So if you like the movie No Country for Old Men, I highly recommend it. But Cormac McCarthy, who was the author of No Country for Old Men and a number of other books, it was a very, very interesting writer. You know, he passed away at the age of 89. One of the other One of the other passings that it's worth commenting on, and I say this before, I've said this before, and I say it with no apologies. I learned to read on comic books when I was a kid, and I was a kid at the time where you had Marvel and DC comic books, and it was the start of the Spider-Man books and the Avengers, all, and I was there all at the beginning, and I kicked myself because I can remember going out and buying these 12-cent comic books, and they've all kind of disappeared over the years. And these are the comic books that you sell for thousands and thousands of dollars now. And I say, yeah, I had Avengers 1, and I had X-Men 1, and I had Fantastic Four 1, and I had Spider-Man 1. I had all these. I had all those, and they've just kind of disappeared over the years. But one of the artists who really helped popularize the comic book revolution of the 60s and the 70s was John Romita Sr. And he was one of the, not the first artist that drew Spider-Man, but one of the earlier earliest artists, who was responsible. And they work with the guy, the writer who develops the storyline, and then what happens is the artists draw in the different stuff, but the artists have a huge impact in helping create the stories and things like that. And John Romita Sr., he passed away at the age of 93, and I always remember his work. I know sometimes when I say I learned to read on comic books, people kind of roll their eyes, and I emphasize this. I firmly believe that as a parent or a grandparent or a mentor, one of the greatest gifts that you can give young people, that you can give children, is the gift of literature. Teach them to read, because I think that so much comes from that. If you develop, like I say, to me, I grew up reading comic books, and that then led to reading newspapers, and that then led to reading novels, and it led to reading biographies. And I think so much of whatever I've accomplished in life, it's because I've always had a love for reading, and I've wanted to learn and do these things. And there's no question about it. I trace it back to comic books. Wyatt, I remember early Spider-Man comic. There was a villain, and the villain was the chameleon, but you spell chameleon CH. It's one of there are few words in the English language, but not many, where the CH, where the H is silent. And I remember as a kid, I couldn't get over that. Whenever I would look at chameleon, I would see Shyamalan. That's what I would see. I'd go to my parents and I'd say, I don't get this. I don't understand why this word is pronounced like that. But and I remember this to this day. And my parents would just say, it's because it is.
I know my sister's not listening, so don't tell her that I said this on the radio, but she had a similar thing. I did as well, and pretty much everyone I knew that was obsessed with reading at a young age did. Hers was she read a biography of Eleanor Roosevelt.
Okay.
And when she went to talk about what she did, she's like, I read this great book about Eleanor Roosevelt.
Oh, yeah. Right. The E-L-E-A-N. Yeah.
Yep.
It's stuff like that. And to this day, when I see the word Shyamalan, I still want to pronounce it Shyamalan. And it's just, I remember, I know it's chameleon. I get it. And I also, don't text me, I know that there's a handful of other words where the H is silent in the U.S., but there's not a lot,
mine was the phlegm, the word phlegm, P-H-E-L-G-M, or right. I think I've spelled that wrong, but I read it in Harry Potter for the first time, and I just did not get the joke.
Right,
because
yeah.
I didn't know how to pronounce that word. I was like, "Is this a British thing?"
It is, but this is the kind of stuff that sticks with. But anyhow, it kind of goes back to the. I remember that. I think that was like the villain was like Spider-Man number 2 or 3. And to this day, we all have words and stuff that we struggle with and stuff. But if you don't give kids that gift of reading and see where it goes, you don't get it. Chloe, one of our texters says Chloe is another CH word. Chloe is like CHLOE. But the H is silent. Chloe.
Yeah, well, and the CH sound in and the spelling in Greek is a K sound. So the CH, like the trainer of heroes in Greek mythology, is Chiron, not Chiron. Another word I mispronounced growing up.
Look at the big brain on Wyatt. There you go.
I took Latin in high school and Greek in college.
Yeah, there are really Latin in high. Huh.
See, Latin was the only language in
high school.
At my high school, Latin was the only language that didn't have a oral requirement because it's a dead language.
Right.
We don't know exactly how to pronounce it, and I was enjoying. I thought it was interesting, and I enjoyed not having to do that.
Huh, interesting. I took Latin in high school. See, you have a much nobler thing. I took Latin in high school because there weren't a lot of people taking.
That's what they were teaching in the Middle Ages,
Jeff? There you go. They didn't have a lot of people that were taking Latin. And so if you took Latin, and the teacher, the late, great Juanita Bonneman, I loved her. But if you took Latin, you were pretty much guaranteed an A, you know, as long as you showed up and made an effort because she wanted people to continue taking it so she could continue to teach Latin and stuff. And she was a sweet, just a wonderful woman who passed away a number of years ago. Yeah, Chloe, C-H. Yeah, that would be another one. And yes, I know it's chameleon. I know it's silent. I know there's a handful of other words like that, but I struggle with it. Okay, it's called the three-month rule. Something completely different. Do you know what that is? And is it accurate? I will explain. We will discuss. The three-month rule, one of our texters says, it's the waiting period for divorce in Wisconsin. That's not accurate. Now, I have no idea what the waiting period for divorce is in Wisconsin. No, don't text me that. Don't care. Not relevant. Not relevant to my life, what the waiting period of the divorce is. All right. The three-month rule. Well, if you are one of the millions and millions and millions of people who are not on TikTok, I'm here to work this out for you. See, here's the deal. And it is an idea being promoted by TikTok. And my producer, Charlie, said, is this a dating rule? I said, yeah, actually it is. Here's TikTok. There's all these videos out there, and I'm going to tell you about it so you don't have to watch them, that talks about the three-month rule, which posits that 3 months is a solid test for whether a couple will ride off into the proverbial sunset or go their separate ways. So in other words, 3 months is kind of the be-all, end-all for relationship success. So the question is, you know, the idea is if you can make it 3 months, that means that it's likely that the relationship will be much, much longer than that. Now, I have very little frame of reference, having been married most of my adult life and happily married my entire adult life. But our number is 855-616-1620. That is the Old National Bank talk and text line. So here is my question to you. What about the three-month rule? If you are looking for that significant other, that partner, and, you know, you meet somebody, and if you're able to, I don't know, stay together, date each other, see each other, after 3 months, is that enough time to realize that, okay, This is going to go somewhere. Now, I think that's pretty soon. Now, candidly, I mean, I can, and again, it's been a long time since I've been in those things, but I can think of situations where I was together with people for, maybe you thought that 3 months was going to be enough, and you didn't find out till like after a year or so that this was not going to work out, or in some cases, even more than that. 3 months. Is that the indicator? If you can stick with somebody for 3 months, is that a good indicator that, okay, maybe there's something here? 855-616-1620. That is the Old National Bank talk and text line. The three-month rule. Does it make sense in today's society? We discuss in just a moment. Okay, that's my producer, Charlie. We're talking about the three-month rule with relationships, and you choose to play Why Don't We Spend the Night Together. All right, interesting choice of music. If you're just tuning in, here's the deal. And I'm saving you having to watch millions of videos on TikTok, but this is one of the highlight things. It's the three-month rule, and that the theory is that 3 months is a solid test for whether or not a couple can tell whether, hey, we're going to be together forever or it's time to separate. You know, 3 months. Now, to me, that's crazy. It's just like absolutely crazy. But I understand that it's kind of a different time. Jeff, I'm in my 60s, and all of my relationships, including my 25-plus-year marriage, either didn't make it past a month or lasted many years. My experience is that 1 month of intense dating exposes most of the good and bad, such that I could make a good determination of long-term prospects. Man, I don't think a month is anywhere a near enough time to find out, you know, the quirks of that. Jeff, I'm dying. 27 years ago, I got pregnant after dating my boyfriend for 3 months. We got married a year later and still are together, but 3 months proves to be true in my case. Jeff, to me, 6 months is more like it, in my opinion. When dating the first 6 months, you're dating that person's representative. You don't really know. Huh. Interesting. Jeff, here's an interesting Wisconsin version of this. I really believe that in Wisconsin, you have to go through all four seasons with your significant other. I learned early on that people really do change with the seasons. So, honey, I love you in spring. I love you in summer. But, man, once fall rolls around, I'm thinking of heading out. I don't know. Interesting. Jeff, 3 months. I'm on 11 years with my boyfriend. I hope he's listening. So they still haven't figured it out after 11 months. I just don't think that there's enough time to I just think 3 months is way sooner. Jeff, I think this is stupid. It doesn't get easier. It just gets harder. I've been married 30 years, and I'm still not sure about it. Well, we're not going to read that person's name. No way about it. I think a lot of times what happens is that you have in relationships, you have that first, oh, gosh, everybody, you know, falls in love so quickly. And then what happens, it's kind of like the giant skyrocket that goes off and then the skyrocket explodes. And then, you know, people go, huh, you know, this I really don't like or that I really don't like. Now, I also think it changes as you get older because, you know, as you get older, you know the traits that you like and you know the traits that you don't like. And, you know, maybe it's a situation where, you know, we don't have, you know, years and years to get to know each other. But the 3 month rule, that seems to me to be a little quick, just saying. But whatever works for different people. But if you see that on TikTok, you now know what it is that they refer to. Hey, I've been promising right before the program ends, I was going to comment on the latest developments in connection with the shared revenue deal. For everybody who hasn't been following this, because of a lot of factors, some of which includes fiscal mismanagement of pension funds over the years, the city of Milwaukee and Milwaukee County are, I'm going to use the phrase, they're broke. I mean, technically, unless you get permission from the legislature, you can't go bankrupt. But they're on an unsustainable financial path. So what's happened is the legislature and the governor have cut a deal where the city of Milwaukee and Milwaukee County are due to get more in shared revenue. Shared revenue is money that the state collects that they send then back to municipalities. So this deal that's been cut that was signed off on by the legislature yesterday and will be signed off by the governor, if not today, in the next day or two, it will send more money back to Milwaukee, both the city and the county. It will also give, so they're going to get that money regardless. It will also give the city of Milwaukee the ability to impose a 2% sales tax that they can use for other purposes, and it'll give the county the ability to impose a 0.4% sales tax, but it needs to be agreed on by 2/3 of the members of the Common Council for the Milwaukee tax and 2/3 of the county board for the sales tax for the county. And a lot of the reports are saying that there's a number of county supervisors and, in particular, a number of members of the Common Council who are out there posturing saying, we don't like this, you know, we don't like the fact that there's strings attached to this, and, you know, we might end up voting no on it. Well, I guess my response to this is, okay, you get to vote no on this, but, you know, don't complain then. Now, I understand why if you're a member of the Common Council or you're a member of the county board, why there are aspects of this legislation you don't like. Because for years and years and years, you have spent money in a way that would, well, be an embarrassment to a drunken sailor. And as a condition of getting your pension problems bailed out, getting financial relief, one of the conditions is you got to change your ways. You can't just spend money however you want to spend money. And there's limits on that. And you can't cut the cops below a certain level. And you can't cut the number of firefighters below a certain level. And yes, you've got to put school resource officers back in at least 25 schools. Oh, the horror. And I understand there's people who are frustrated with that. And they want to take the money and they want to spend it in the same reckless fashions that they've been spending the money for years and years. And they can't do it. So I get the under fact that some of these people are upset with that. How dare you tell us, you know, how we can spend money? Well, okay, that's the way of the world. That's the reality. So if you decide that you don't like the strings and you're going to vote no on this, or, you know, two-thirds don't vote yes, that's okay. But don't complain anymore. Don't complain when you don't have enough money for this or that or the other thing. I get that it's not a perfect deal. I understand some of the restraints on local spending, but my only message is if the county board hadn't created the whole pension fiasco 20 years ago that still haunts Milwaukee County, if the Common Council had been more responsible when it came to spending, starting with the pension giveaways and then all sorts of other things over the years, you wouldn't be in this dire financial strait. And so, yes, it's true. There are some limitations on what you can do with this money. But in many respects, I think you can make the argument that it's for your own good. So at the end of the day, will the Common Council come around? Yes, they will come around, because there's really no alternative to coming around. They're going to have to do it, or they're going to be continued to drive off this financial cliff. Same thing is true with the county board. But just keep that in mind with all this posturing. At the end of the day, they're going to vote for it, or a two-thirds majority will vote for it, because they really have no other choice. And for everybody who complains, the reason they're in this situation is because current and past members of either the Common Council or the County Board just acted in an irresponsible fashion. And now this is what they've got to accept if they want to get out of that.